Alabama says no to abortion. Wyoming's Enzi says no to a fifth term. And there may be no Democrats left who aren't running for president. And yes, it's all on the Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. A new Alabama law restricting abortion could lead to the Supreme Court deciding the future of Roe.
The general conclusion that Roe is in imminent peril is correct, and Roe is likely to be overturned in a matter of years. But I think it's much more likely to take a little while.
Plus, as the battle for control of the Senate heats up, Democrats are finding that many of their most sought-after candidates won't run.
Whether it's President Trump in his second term or a new Democratic president, their effectiveness will be impacted by the control of Congress and, you know, even more specifically, control of the Senate.
And with the presidential debates just 6 weeks away, who will make the cut?
I can say definitively that 11 candidates have qualified through both routes. Those are Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, Amy Klobuchar, Beto O'Rourke, Andrew Yang, Tulsi Gabbard, Cory Booker, and Julian Castro.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 277 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The Democratic presidential field has grown by two in the past couple of weeks, with the entry of Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado and Montana Governor Steve Bullock. Bennett made his announcement on the program CBS This Morning.
I think this country faces two enormous challenges, among others. One is a lack of economic mobility and opportunity for most Americans, and the other is the need to restore integrity to our government. I think we need to do both of those things. And I've spent the last couple of years writing a book about our politics over the last 10 years or so, and I became convinced in that process that if we continue to go down the path we're going, and this isn't just about President Trump, it's about the politics that existed before he got there. He certainly has made matters worse. But if we keep going down this road, we're going to be the first generation of Americans to leave less opportunity, not more, to the next generation. And I just need to do everything I can do to make sure that we don't do that.
And this is from Bullock's announcement video.
I believe in an America where every child has a fair shot to do better than their parents. But we all know that that kind of opportunity no longer exists for most people. For far too many, it never has. That's why we need to defeat Donald Trump in 2020 and defeat the corrupt system that lets campaign money drown out the people's voice, so we can finally make good on the promise of a fair shot for everyone. This is the fight of our time. It's been the fight of my career. I'm Steve Bullock, and I'm running for president. With your help, we will take our democracy back.
That makes it either 22 or 23 Democratic candidates running. For some reason, not everyone is counting Mike Gravel, the former Alaska senator, who has also declared. Later in the program, we'll talk about who gets included in next month's debates. And while the number of presidential candidates keeps climbing, the number of Senate retirees is increasing as well. Mike Enzi of Wyoming, a Republican first elected in 1996 to replace the retiring Alan Simpson, announced last week that he will not seek a fifth term next year. He's the fourth senator to decline re-election in 2020, joining fellow Republicans Lamar Alexander of Tennessee and Pat Roberts of Kansas and Democrat Tom Udall of New Mexico. For the Wyoming seat, there is much speculation on the future of Liz Cheney, Wyoming's at-large member of the House, whose attempt to oust Enzi 5 years ago ended disastrously. She is considered the leading contender for the seat if she wants it. And that leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last child of a former vice president to run for the Senate? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Don't call me daughter, not be true. The picture kept will remind me. Don't call me daughter, not be true. The picture kept will remind me. Don't call me.
Access to abortion has long been an issue which has stirred the political pot. President Reagan talked about it.
We must not rest, and I pledge to you that I will not rest until a human life amendment becomes a part of our Constitution.
President George Bush was asked about abortion during many press conferences.
Are you opposed to federal funding to help pay for the abortions for young women who are victims of rape or incest? Are you an ultimately opposed, or is there some room?
Yes, I'm opposed, and I'll hope we'll see what we can do in terms of the conference committee to see if there is room for flexibility.
His son, President George W. Bush, was very strong on issues involving life.
And we reaffirm that the United States of America is building a culture of life.
And while Donald Trump had this to say to NBC's Tim Russert on Meet the Press in 1999,
I am pro-choice in every respect, and as far as it goes,
he clearly doesn't feel that way today.
Under my administration, we will always defend the very first right in the Declaration of Independence, and that is the right to life.
Presidential rhetoric is one thing. Actions from the states are another. A recent bunch of rulings from Republican-led states have resulted in more restrictions than ever before on a procedure that was legalized by the Supreme Court more than 45 years ago. On Tuesday, the Alabama Senate approved a measure that would essentially ban all abortions in the state. No exceptions for rape or incest, and doctors who perform the procedure could face up to 99 years in prison. As of this recording, Governor Kay Ivey, a Republican, has not indicated whether she would support the measure, but many in her party expect her to. Last week, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp signed a bill that banned abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy, the so-called heartbeat bill, which is similar to what was passed earlier this year in Kentucky, Mississippi, and Ohio. Court challenges are expected in each state, which is fine with proponents of the measures. They would love the issue to reach the U.S. Supreme Court, which, with President Trump's two justices, is more conservative than ever before, and which could very well determine the future of the Roe v. Wade decision. Mary Ziegler is a professor at the Florida State University College of Law and an expert on women's reproductive issues and the Constitution. Professor Ziegler, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as I said in my introduction, politicians have been debating and, well, politicizing abortion for decades now, but I don't know if abortion rights have ever been as threatened as they seem to be now.
I think that's right. I mean, I think we certainly believed that they were just as threatened in the late 80s and early 90s when Anthony Kennedy joined the Supreme Court. But of course, that he proved to everybody wrong and defied expectations and joined a plurality upholding Roe. So I think that it's right. There's more, I mean, certainly more of an existential threat to the Roe decision than there has been since I've been studying this issue.
Can you give us a little more detail, at least more than I mentioned earlier, about what was passed in Alabama and what some of the other states are doing?
Sure. So the Alabama law bans all abortions with one exception for severe threats to a woman's either life or a major bodily function. It doesn't allow for abortions in cases of rape or incest. It also allows for abortions, I should mention, in cases in which a fetus was going to die anyway, conditions incompatible with life. So it's pretty extreme. We've seen a variety of so-called heartbeat bills, which ban abortion around the 6 week of pregnancy, which is when proponents claim a fetal heartbeat can be detected. Georgia's is sort of the most noteworthy because it also includes language explicitly recognizing fetal personhood at 6 weeks, which would mean not only that a fetus is a person for the purposes of abortion law, but for all other legal purposes in Georgia, which raises all kinds of thorny legal questions. And then we still see some more incremental bills, for example, laws banning abortion at 20 weeks on the ground that fetal pain is possible then, laws banning the most common abortion procedure that takes place after the first trimester. Those are called dismemberment abortion laws. So there's really no shortage of options if the Supreme Court wants to hear challenges to Roe. They have a lot of different alternatives.
Well, you mentioned the word incremental, and that's what struck out with me with what's going on in Alabama, because usually it seems to be that conservatives try to chip away at access to abortion, but there's no chipping away in Alabama.
No, I think part of what you're seeing here is that there's been a strategic division within the anti-abortion movement for decades now between incrementalists and absolutists. So incrementalists are not different in their views on abortion. They would like to ban all abortions too, but they don't think that that's strategically productive. So these groups instead think that the court is going to take some time to warm up to the idea of overturning Roe, especially because the justices, in particular, Chief Justice Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh, spent a lot of time talking about their respect for precedent. Chief Justice Roberts seems interested in upholding the court's reputation as a nonpartisan institution. So these groups think the court is much more likely to undo Roe over the course of a series of decisions rather than in one fell swoop. And the idealist camp, which I think you can see the Alabama law sort of exemplifies, these groups either think that the court is ready to overturn Roe now or that it's the right thing to do, both in terms of the results on Election Day and in terms of principle, to ban all abortions now, really, regardless of what the Supreme Court is going to do.
What do you account for with all of this? Is it because of the election of Donald Trump? Is it because it's a more conservative Supreme Court? Is it both?
It's both, I think. So when Anthony Kennedy, who was the most recently departed justice, was on the court, it was pretty obvious that the court wasn't going to overturn Roe because Kennedy had helped to write the Casey decision, which rejected an attempt to overturn Roe. So it was unlikely he was going to change his mind on that. By contrast with Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and even Justices Roberts and Alito, we just don't know what they think about overturning Roe. And we have every reason to believe that they would be skeptical about upholding Roe, given that they've been vetted by the Federalist Society. So I think from the standpoint of anti-abortion legislators, it's certainly worth a shot. And Donald Trump's election's also been significant, in part because I think anti-abortion legislators believe that Trump followed a different playbook in 2016, essentially by kind of energizing and turning out his base instead of trying to appeal to voters in the middle. So in states like Georgia that are sort of becoming bluer, these laws may actually offend a lot of voters, but the bet that lawmakers are making is that they will be exciting and inspiring enough to their base that it won't matter if they don't really appeal to lots of other voters.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, we've always been hearing that polls show that the nation is pretty much divided into so-called pro-choice and pro-life camps, and that there is a political risk of one side going too far. But it didn't seem like, certainly from watching the Alabama debate, it didn't seem like there was any fear by these lawmakers that they were going too far, because I guess these are states where abortion rights are not wildly popular to begin with.
And that's certainly true of Alabama. Alabama is a fairly unique state, in part because of how important religion is to Alabama voters. If you look at exit polls from 2016, you know, the really high percentages of people identified as evangelical Protestants. That was true of both Black and white voters. So anti-abortion positions in Alabama are appealing in a way that may be unique in the United States. I think in Georgia, the calculus may be a little different. Georgia has large metro areas. It's a diverse, complex state, like I said, that is actually probably trending bluer, at least it was in 2016. So I think in Georgia, more what you see is the kind of Donald Trump play, right, where Governor Brian Kemp and other Republicans think that those who are opposed to abortion care much more about the issue than those who may either be pro-choice or those in the middle who may be kind of neither pro-choice nor pro-life, but who wouldn't like a bill like this. They're betting that those voters are going to be more likely to turn out and support them than other voters would be.
In all the analysis I've been reading about Alabama and Georgia as well, everybody says, well, you know, these laws are going to be challenged in court. But is it what I also seem to be understanding is that this is actually the goals of the pro-life movement, to do exactly that, get them into the court or a conservative U.S. Supreme Court and have them rule not only on the individual legislation, but on the future of Roe itself.
Yeah, that's absolutely the goal. I mean, Alabama lawmakers more or less said that they have absolutely no intention of enforcing this law. And I mean, when it comes, for example, to rape and incest exceptions, some lawmakers said, you know, we're actually in favor of rape and incest exceptions. We don't want to put them in the bill because we want to force the court to take on the Roe decision. So that's absolutely the point of these laws, sometimes the exclusive point of these laws.
You know, it seems like not long ago, Republican lawmakers felt that, well, one, that overturning Roe would result in a huge political backlash. And now it doesn't seem like it seems risky to fight to end abortion. It seems like they are ready and willing for this confrontation.
That's true, although I don't think it's as true nationwide as it is in states like Alabama and Georgia. I'm sure you might have noticed that President Trump, who's not shy about saying controversial things, has really kind of avoided saying anything about laws like the Georgia or Alabama law and is still sticking to talking points about pro-choice folks being supportive of infanticide or late abortion. So I think there's still a concern in some parts of the GOP that the country isn't ready for laws like the Alabama and Georgia law and that the Supreme Court might not be either. So I think there's definitely been a shift in terms of how the GOP views a potential backlash, but it isn't a uniform shift. And I imagine that there are some in GOP circles and in the pro-life movement more broadly who are nervous today about a potential backlash, even to the Alabama bill.
How tenuous do you think is the Roe decision?
Tenuous in terms of odds that it'll be overruled. I think the court will overrule it. I don't think the court will overrule it as quickly as Alabama or Georgia legislators expect. And I think that there's a certain amount of sort of pie in the sky optimism in terms of the timeline and the strategy that they're using. Because these legislators, I think, expect the court to overturn Roe in probably a single decision in a matter of a year or two, and potentially to recognize fetal personhood as well. And it's hard for me to see there being 5 votes for either of those things in the next couple of years. I think that the general conclusion that Roe is in imminent peril is correct, and Roe is likely to be overturned in a matter of years. But I think it's much more likely to take a little while and probably take several judicial opinions by the Supreme Court, not just one.
Mary Ziegler is a professor at the Florida State University School of Law. She's the author of 2 books, After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate, and Beyond Abortion, Roe v. Wade and the Fight for Privacy. Mary, thanks for a great discussion.
Thanks for having me.
With so much attention being focused on next year's campaign for the White House, it may be understandable if we lose focus on the battle for the control of the Senate. But it would also be short-sighted. Republican control of the Senate, along with the disappearance of the filibuster, has allowed President Trump to put 2 conservatives on the Supreme Court, with the possibility of more to come. It has confirmed a record number of conservative judges to federal courts across the country. It even blocked President Obama from filling a Supreme Court vacancy during his last year in office. 34 Senate seats are at stake next year, and on paper, this should be good news for the Democrats, because 22 of the 34 are held by Republicans. But very few GOP seats seem to be at risk, at least as of now, and so things would have to change dramatically, say a wave election, for the Democrats to win a majority. Dems would need a net gain of 3 or 4 to make that happen. Nathan Gonzalez is following the battle for the Senate control, and he joins us now. He's the editor and publisher of Inside Elections, the nonpartisan political website that covers races for the House and Senate and the presidency. Nathan, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Thank you for having me, particularly because we're not focusing on the presidential race. These are important. There are other important races, too, so I appreciate the opportunity.
Before I get into the individual races, I want you to describe the importance of having a majority in the Senate with the filibuster gone.
Well, I think ultimately, whether it's President Trump in his second term or a new Democratic president, their effectiveness will be impacted by the control of Congress and, you know, even more specifically, control of the Senate. I mean, if it is divided or if the Senate is split control if it's still a Republican Senate and a Democratic president, there is a very limited amount of things that a Democratic president is going to be able to get done. But you wouldn't know it from the kind of disproportionate coverage that the media spends on the presidential race versus congressional races.
I mean, I agree with you completely, because even if a Democrat is elected to the White House next year, having Mitch McConnell stay on a Senate majority leader could mean that the new president would be hard-pressed to get anything done.
Right. And, you know, the leader McConnell has said that he will be, what was his specific, you know, he will be the roadblock or the wall for any socialist policies or something like that. And Democrats are up in arms, but that's the reality. It's both good messaging for him to Republicans, but it's the reality of the situation.
And just mention the name Merrick Garland, and you'll see what power that McConnell has as Senate Majority Leader.
Exactly, and that's I think he set a precedent for what could come if the chess pieces are in a few different places down the line.
Okay, so let's go to next year's races. I mean, I think the big headlines have been about those Democratic candidates who aren't running. I mean, I'm not talking about the Senate retirees like Tom Udall of New Mexico, but candidates who were strongly recruited but opted against running, like Stacey Abrams in Georgia or Steve Bullock in Montana, John Hickenlooper in Colorado, Beto O'Rourke, and Julian Castro in Texas.
I think there's a couple of things come to mind on this. First, I think there's a divide between what's good for the party and what's good for this individual person. You know, if you take Stacey Abrams, for example, it's probably best for the party for her to run in Georgia, but I think she might realize that getting two consecutive losses under her belt right away might not be good for her political future or how people look at her political future. But I'm not convinced Stacey Abrams would have been Democrats' best candidate for the Senate in Georgia this cycle. I understand her profile and her ability to raise money, but maybe having a national profile isn't the right way to win in Georgia this cycle. Maybe you need someone who has less of a political record. But a big picture thing is that I just think it's too early to grade candidate recruitment. And I think we get in this rut every cycle.
But if you think of the four open seats because of retirements, you have Tom Udall, the Democrat in New Mexico. You have Lamar Alexander in Tennessee. You have the Republicans. You have Lamar Alexander, Pat Roberts of Kansas, and Mike Enzi of Wyoming. I would assume all four stay in the same party.
Yeah, right now we have them all rated as solid. You know, it's good to be open-minded, particularly this early in the cycle, but I think the primaries are the most exciting races. You know, are waiting to see what Secretary of State Mike Pompeo decides in Kansas. You know, I was told by a source he might wait all the way until Christmas before deciding. There are other candidates moving around. Congressman Roger Marshall clearly wants to run and is trying to position himself if Pompeo ultimately declines to run, you know, but there are good storylines here. I mean, whether potentially Liz Cheney moving up from the House to the Senate in Wyoming is an interesting story. She could face former Congresswoman Cynthia Loomis in a primary there. So it's not interesting in terms of partisan control, but the intra-party fights is a fun storyline as well.
Now, one seat we never talk about, talking about Republican seats, one thing we never talk about is Susan Collins in Maine. But I think you know, maybe you'll, I think you agree that she's lost a lot of goodwill with the vote for Judge Kavanaugh, with the vote for Trump tax cuts. I mean, this is not the Susan Collins that many moderates in moderate Maine remember.
Yeah, Democrats around the country rallied against Susan Collins during the Kavanaugh hearing, and basically pledged to donate, you know, up to over $4 million for the eventual Democratic nominee. There still isn't a clear declared candidate. I've been sources telling me that it will be the state speaker, Sarah Gideon, who was the most likely challenger. And I get it that Susan Collins has been running in Maine for a long time. She's defeated formidable candidates, including Tom Allen, who represented half the state. I mean, she just destroyed him. But I think we are moving into an era where having these kind of local profiles, I think that era is coming to an end. And, you know, for example, Joe Manchin in 2018 in West Virginia, you know, thought to have this stellar brand, ran against an underwhelming candidate and won by, I think, three points. You know, I think that should be concerning to someone like Susan Collins, that you can't just rely on this local connection when you have these national pressures that are coming into play. And we didn't even touch on, I think, one of the marquee races will be the Arizona Senate race between Senator Martha McSally and Mark Kelly, the former astronaut and husband of former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, in a state that's going to be increasingly competitive at the presidential level. I think that's going to be one of the marquee Senate contests anywhere in the country.
Yes, it's not often that somebody runs for the Senate, loses, and then gets appointed to the Senate and has to fight for survival the very next cycle.
Right. We have it as a toss-up because she just lost in the other seat, you know, 15 minutes ago. So I don't think I think McSally is more vulnerable than Susan Collins, even though Susan Collins, along with Cory Gardner, are the only two Republican senators up for re-election in Hillary Clinton states. You know, Trump won Arizona, but McSally has some proving to do that she can make this race different than the last one.
Are you pretty confident that Mark Kelly will be the Democratic nominee there?
I am confident that he'll be the Democratic nominee. What I'm actually less confident is just how he's going to perform as a candidate. I'm told that he's good, and we know his profile. I mean, he's an astronaut. He's probably done more to help society than I'll ever do in my life. But we don't know how he's going to be as a candidate. And you know from following these races for a little while, a few decades, that sometimes you can be so successful in any other area of life, and it just sometimes it doesn't translate into being a good candidate. And I think that's what we're waiting to see with Mark Kelly.
Not to compare him to other astronauts, but I remember the first time John Glenn ran for the Senate in 1970. He was a great story, but it was an abysmal candidate. He ran as a celebrity, and voters didn't want him, and he learned his lesson.
I think there's also a generational... I think folks of an older generation, astronauts were household names because of the pioneers that they were. I don't think astronauts are necessarily household names these days. And so I think it's a good way. It's a good profile. He's not a politician, although he's waded into the gun issue with his wife over the last few years. But we'll see.
Nathan Gonzalez is the editor and publisher of Inside Elections. Nathan, thanks a lot.
No problem.
We're just over a month away from the first debate of the Democrats running for president. At last count, 22 are seeking their party's nomination. That's all fine and dandy, except for one thing. Only 20, or a maximum of 20, will be invited to the debate stage June 26th and 27th in Miami, broadcast by NBC, MSNBC, and Telemundo. So who makes the cut? Who's already in like Flynn? And who's on the cusp? My go-to person on this is Maggie Astor. She's a political reporter with the New York Times and has been chronicling the candidates in detail. Maggie, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into who's in and who's still trying to make the cut, please explain what led to the DNC to write these rules for the debates.
Well, back in 2016, the DNC was accused by some Democrats of sort of putting their thumb on the scales for Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. Whether or not that is accurate, it was certainly a widespread perception at the time. And so when they started planning for the 2020 race and understood that quite a lot of candidates were going to be joining, I think they sort of wanted to come out very early and say, these are the criteria, we're being very transparent about them, so that there would be no accusation that they were, you know, picking and choosing subjectively.
And what is that criteria?
So candidates can qualify for the debate in one of two ways. The first is the polling route. They need to register 1% or more support in at least three different polls conducted either by different organizations or in a different place, either national or a specific state. Or they can have at least 65,000 individual donors, including at least 200 in at least 20 states. So you can qualify either of those ways, but priority will be given to the people who qualify both ways if there are more than 20 qualifiers.
Now, this is what they're doing is difficult than what the Republicans did last time out. The Republicans, basically, they had, I guess they had the stronger candidates in the primetime debate and the others, the George Pataki's, the Bobby Jindals at the kids' table.
Yes. The DNC is not doing that. The debate is going to be split over two nights with a maximum of 10 people on each night, but they will be divided between the two nights randomly, not based on their performance.
Okay, so who's in so far? Which candidates have the polling numbers and the donors to get them included?
So as far as we can tell, and I should qualify up front that not every campaign has released their donor numbers, so we can't be 100% sure that we are including everyone. But I can say definitively that 11 candidates have qualified through both routes. Those are Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, Amy Klobuchar, Beto O'Rourke, Andrew Yang, Tulsi Gabbard, Cory Booker, and Julian Castro.
So now the others we're talking about, like Kirsten Gillibrand.
Yes, she has qualified through the polling route, but she has not yet reached the donor threshold.
Okay. In the past couple of days, Senator Michael Bennet of Colorado and Montana Governor Steve Bullock have jumped into the race. With the debates just 6 weeks away, do they have enough time to qualify?
Well, they certainly have enough time to qualify through polls, because especially as we, you know, with every week that passes, we're starting to get more polls. So it is certainly technically possible for them to amass at least three polls that they're at 1% in over the next month. That's definitely possible. The donor bar is, I mean, yes, it's possible, but it's a much harder sell. You know, there are candidates who have broken that threshold in their first day. Joe Biden, for example, raised money from more than 65,000 people in the first day of his campaign. And then there are people like Booker and Castro who have been campaigning since much earlier this year, and they only broke the threshold this month. So it really varies by candidate, but certainly for lesser-known figures like Bullock or Bennett, it's a difficult sell. It's not impossible, but it'll be difficult.
Well, my math shows 22 candidates. What if all 22 qualify?
Then the priority will be given to the candidates who have met both requirements, so that's 11 so far. And after they put in those 11 candidates who qualified both ways, candidates who qualified through polling but not with donors will be the next in. So the DNC will be prioritizing the polling over the donors if it gets to that tiebreaker step. Currently, to my knowledge, there are another six people in that category, which would bring us up to 17 in the debates. The next step would be people who have qualified with donors but not polls. And there is only one person in that category right now, and that's Marianne Williamson.
It sounds like this process is making candidates announce their candidacy earlier than they might have liked.
You know, it's certainly possible. I don't have any evidence to say that that's been a factor in decisions about when to announce, but certainly the candidates who announced earlier have had an advantage in reaching those thresholds.
So tell me, what's the deadline? When's the deadline to be included?
Well, candidates have until June 13th to submit their polling and donor data to the DNC. So that's about 2 weeks before the first debate and about a month from now.
And you'll be updating your charts at newyorktimes.com, and we'll be watching in real time who's going to make it. Is that correct?
Well, we don't have a live updating chart, but we are certainly continuing to cover the debate qualifications in new articles as things change.
Maggie, I demand that you have a live running total. Maggie Astor is a political reporter with the New York Times. Maggie, it was great having you on The Political Junkie.
Yeah, great being here.
Que sera, sera. Whatever will be, will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera. What will be, will be.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question, which was, who was the last former Democratic vice president who was denied his party's presidential nomination? The answer, Hubert Humphrey. Vice president under Lyndon Johnson from 1965 through 1968, when he ran for president, he tried again in 1972, but lost the nomination to George McGovern. And the randomly selected winner is Adam Gordon of Newton, Massachusetts. Adam wins the coveted Political Junkie button. And we have a Scuttlebutton winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. Our last contest had just two buttons. The first was a picture button of Joe Biden for his bid to win the presidency in 2020. The other was a Massachusetts button for Charles Feeley for state representative. So when you combine Joe Biden, and you know what he's well known for, with Charles Feeley, you kind of get touchy-feely, which, for better or worse, describes Joe Biden. And the winner is Art Crum of Yamhill, Oregon. There's already a new Scuttlebutton puzzle up on our website. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Come on, come on, come on, come on, now touch me, babe. Can't you see that I am not afraid? What was that promise that you made? Why won't you tell me what she said? What was that promise that you made? Now I'm gonna love you till the heavens stop the rain.
It's time for This Week in Political History. It is, without question, one of the most monumental Supreme Court decisions in American history. 65 years ago this week, in a unanimous decision, the court ruled that separate public schools for black and white students were unequal. 7 months before the decision, while the case was still before the court, President Eisenhower made a major announcement.
President Eisenhower appoints Governor Earl Warren of California as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. The 62-year-old Californian, shown here with his family, becomes the 14th man in our history to occupy the nation's highest judicial post. He succeeds the late Fred M. Vinson of Kentucky. Governor of his state for 10 years, Earl Warren will be the second Republican on the Supreme Court. He will preside over a tribunal which is faced with history-making decisions.
The case was Brown v. Board of Education, and Warren, knowing the significance of what was at stake, worked to make sure it was a unanimous ruling. It was a decision that changed civil rights in this country forever, and it changed our politics forever as well, for better and worse. Roger Smith is a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of several books on race, including The Unsteady March, The Rise and Decline of Racial Equality in America. Professor Smith, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I'm not especially great with adjectives, so I'll turn to you on this. How important and historic was the Brown decision?
There is probably not another decision of the Supreme Court that is equally historic. It represented the fundamental turning point in American constitutional development in which the United States did officially repudiate the notion that this was a white man's nation, a notion that had been enshrined in local, state, and some federal laws throughout our nation's history.
Well, I want to play a piece of tape from a PBS documentary of someone reading the language of Warren's decision. I want you to hear it, and then we'll go back to what he had to say.
We conclude that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. Separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. Therefore, we unanimously hold that the plaintiffs are deprived of the equal protection of the laws guaranteed by the 14th Amendment.
How important was it that the decision was unanimous?
The Supreme Court justices certainly thought it was important that it would be unanimous because segregation laws were so deeply entrenched in not just the American South, but parts of the American Midwest, and were accepted practices in many other parts of the country as well. And they expected that there could be massive resistance to the invalidation of segregation and that this could undermine the credibility of the federal judiciary itself. And so they thought they had to send a unanimous signal. They did get that massive resistance. It's not clear that the unanimity achieved all they hoped for it, but Earl Warren did work very hard to bring everyone around to a unanimous opinion. That wasn't the initial vote on the Supreme Court, and he did it successfully.
There was a lot of talk in the decision that it threw out the, quote, separate but equal argument. Remind us where that language came from.
That comes from the 1896 decision of Plessy versus Ferguson, which upheld a Louisiana law requiring segregated railroad cars, something that the railroad companies opposed because they wanted either to offer segregated cars or integrated cars, whichever would be most likely to maximize revenue. But in the 1890s, as the Republicans had suffered electoral defeats for their continuing efforts to support racial equality, by the mid-1890s, both parties had decided that they would acquiesce in the rebuilding of systems of white supremacy in reality, but they would do it through systems in which officially the law provided only for racial segregation, not for unequal public facilities or other public institutions. And that was to reconcile the policies of racial segregation with the language of the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. There was not sufficient support in the country to overturn the 14th Amendment, so they had to comply with it on its face. And saying that we're offering railroad facilities that are racially segregated, but they're still equal, separate but equal, was an effort to comply with the Equal Protection Clause. In fact, the facilities were never equal, nor were they ever intended to be equal. But the Supreme Court in 1896 nonetheless accepted the claim that separate but equal facilities are consistent with the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, and segregation laws and practices spread like wildfire after that through the first part of the 20th century.
Well, let me fast forward to the 1950s. Tell me who was Brown, and tell me, maybe explain what was the state of public education in America in 1954.
Well, by 1954, public education, which originated in the Northeast in the 1830s, really had become a practice throughout the nation. The South was the last to establish extensive public education systems. It had now done so, and in the mid-20th century economy, education really had become essential to prepare people to participate in economic and civic life, as the Brown versus Board of Education opinion stresses. It was no longer an overwhelmingly agrarian society in which, for rural farm work, you didn't need so much education. Now, Brown refers to the father of Linda Brown, who was an African-American schoolgirl in Topeka, Kansas, and Kansas was one of the states outside the South that did have legal segregation laws. They had been put in to discourage the migration of African-Americans from the South to the Midwest during the late 19th and early 20th century, and Linda Brown's father wanted her to be able to attend the legally all-white elementary school because it was both closer to his home and better funded and supported than the schools that Topeka was providing for African-American students. And again, in Kansas, as throughout the country, access to effective education had become fundamental to opportunities for all American children.
You pointed out earlier how important it was for the court decision to be unanimous, but obviously there was no unanimity in the country in the response to the Brown decision. How did Congress respond?
Well, virtually all the Southern members of Congress signed a Southern manifesto denouncing the Brown versus Board of Education decision as an inaccurate reading of the Constitution, as a kind of unconstitutional judicial activism. Lyndon Johnson of Texas refused to sign it, and Al Gore Sr., the father of Al Gore, later Clinton's vice president, they refused to sign it.
Al Gore from Tennessee, right.
Right. But the rest of the Southern congressmen did, and that represented a very strong congressional pushback against the decision that reflected the reaction throughout the White South.
And did it lead, is it fair to say that it led to the Faubuses and the Wallaces and others like them in politics?
Yes, it is quite striking that both Orville Faubus of Arkansas and George Wallace of Alabama were initially seen as racial moderates. But as white public opinion in the South became increasingly inflamed against efforts to in school segregation and the segregation of a variety of other public facilities in the 1950s, as they felt that this was the federal government bossing around the South again, and also they were deeply attached to their economic and social system of racial hierarchy. Then a lot of Southern politicians, including Faubus and Wallace, decided that the road to success was to champion segregation ardently, and both did so, with Wallace using it as the issue that propelled him first to Alabama's governorship and then into national presidential politics in the 1960s.
What did Brown accomplish, and what's its lasting effect today?
On the one hand, the Brown decision did play this vital historical role of announcing that officially laws that in effect established whites as the dominant race in the United States, the privileged race, the laws expressing beliefs in white supremacy, these were now held inconsistent with the Equal Protection Clause, and that repudiation of white supremacist conceptions of American identity is of fundamental and enduring importance. At the same time, the Brown decision did not succeed in preventing massive resistance. That resistance was very successful from the time of 1954 through the late 1960s, a period in which the practices of school segregation in the United States changed almost not at all. The schools were just as segregated in 1967 as they were in 1954. At that point, the Supreme Court, aided by Congress and the president's support for new civil rights laws, the 64 Civil Rights Law, the 65 Voting Rights Act, with the creation of new federal agencies of enforcement. Then the federal courts began pushing southern states and border states harder actually to end the segregated pattern of their schools, to remedy it by achieving school integration. And they had some success in doing so in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And then the courts began turning north and addressing practices of official complicity in segregated schools throughout the country. But that led to decades of struggle over school segregation and integration and mandatory busing to achieve school integration. This contributed to many middle-class parents, white parents, and then eventually black parents moving away from urban school systems into suburbs where desegregation orders were less likely to be enacted by courts. And this depleted the resource base for urban public schools in many parts of the country, including my own city of Philadelphia. And those urban schools gradually became not as a matter of public policy, but as a matter of the residential choices practically available to different communities of Americans. Those urban schools became overwhelmingly non-white, effectively segregated schools, even though they are no longer, since Brown versus Board of Education, legally segregated schools, and often severely underfunded and under-resourced schools. So the reality is that in the 21st century, we have patterns of schools that are very close to racially segregated in many parts of the country, with the Northeast as bad or worse in that regard as any section of the country. And in many urban areas, again, including Philadelphia, the public schools are in crisis. Now, Brown versus Board of Education was by no means responsible for all of that, and none of it takes away from the fact that its repudiation of notions of America as a white supremacist land, that was tremendously important. But it is true that it is part of a set of events that have left us with public schools that are all too segregated and all too under-resourced in many parts of the nation today.
So when I look at your book's title, The Rise and Decline of Racial Equality in America, I'm assuming the Brown decision is part of the rise and the subsequent resegregation of schools is probably part of the decline.
Absolutely. And you know, that book, which I wrote with Philip Klinkner of Hamilton College, he was really the primary author, came out in 1999, about 5 years ago. I co-authored another book with Desmond King of Oxford called Still a House Divided, and that title indicated that the patterns of segregation are persisting and in some ways deepening in many areas of American life, not just schools, well into the 21st century, right up to the present day.
What do you think the lasting legacy of the Brown decision is?
I do think that its most important and most lasting legacy is this rejection of the notion that it's okay for the law legally to privilege whites over others, or in general, to promote racial inequality, whatever the group beneficiaries might be. And it is part of a set of judicial and legislative developments that include not only the 64 Civil Rights Act, the 65 Voting Rights Act, but also the 1965 Immigration Act, which ended the national origins quota system that had been deliberately put in place in the 1920s in order to ensure that most Americans would be of white Northern European ancestry. These were a set of developments that rejected the notion that America was supposed to be a white nation, and they contributed to the creation of a much more racially and ethnically diverse, multicultural nation with a significantly greater measure of equality, liberty, and justice for all. That's the most important legacy of the Brown decision. But it is also part of a pattern of federal and state policy making in relation to public education that while done with the noblest of intentions in most cases have left us in a situation now where our public school system in many areas is in serious disarray.
Roger Smith is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of several books on race. Professor Smith, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
It was 65 years ago this week, on May 17th, 1954, that the U.S. Supreme Court, in a unanimous 9-0 decision, stated that, quote, separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh, and know they love you.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
And feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and